Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today. I'm very happy to be back with KZYX this summer with a new series of programs. I'm calling these an antinomian hour. I'm using the word antinomian, a very old concept, to describe people who work against the grain, who think for themselves, people who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing. Our program consists of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Amy Trachtenberg. Amy is a painter, a designer, a studio artist, a public artist. She's worked in many cultural areas, theater, opera, dance, architecture, and she lives today in and works in San Francisco. I have her resume here before me. It consists of a very long list of shows and exhibitions and publications, much too long to summarize, but it's well worth seeing, visiting. You might look at it at her website, which is amytrachtenberg.org. Amy was educated at Cal State Sonoma. She took classes at Santa Rosa JC, and then she studied for many years, I think, in Paris. She's today a well-known Bay Area artist and public artist. We'll discuss this today. And she's also an artist whose work sometimes reflects her political concerns. Amy, it's not so easy to discuss studio art on the radio. I think you're quite used to this, but perhaps we could give it a try. Anyway, Amy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh,
Hi, great.
Glad to have you here. So I thought I'd ask you about that, how you see yourself as an artist, but we might begin a bit with your background, maybe about how you came to be an artist and how you found your way to Sonoma County for a start.
Okay. Well, it's nice to be talking to folks in Mendocino. I grew up in a pretty artistic family. Starting even with my grandmother, who never formally would have called herself an artist, and my mother, who was a practicing collage artist as I was growing up. And through my youth, I was always making things and absorbing various cultures and collecting things from various cultures and from nature, both of, I think, which continue to greatly inform the way I make my work. In college, I started out at Sonoma State, and while there, found that the art department at the Santa Rosa Junior College had some very, very strong teachers. So I took classes there. That was drawing and painting, and I also worked as a model for life drawing classes and painting classes and learned quite a bit from the process of being still and absorbing the lessons from those very good artist teachers, in that was the 70s. I also was a Francophile from a very young age and was trying very hard to get back to France, where I had gone for several months after high school. I got out of high school early, as soon as I could, and did go to France and Spain and Morocco and Corsica, just, you know, hitchhiking and doing what people did in the 70s, and it was just hugely rich. So there I visited museums and looked at landscapes and kept drawing journals and met some people older than me that were already becoming very serious artists. So that had an impact, and I think just being close to people who were very immersed in all kinds of forms of art, whether it was dance or poetry, writing, and visual art and music making, just been very important. While I was still at Sonoma State, I was focusing on both French and a great books program called, and I got an opportunity to go sets and costumes for a small company in Petaluma called Cinnabar Opera, Cinnabar Theater, and we went to France together for the summer where I did sets and costumes. And Cal, are you there?
Yeah, sorry, listening. Yeah. Very interesting.
Okay, good. And I decided from there, I did sets for operas by Handel and some very contemporary pieces in Chartres and Dijon, and lived in a medieval village called Vézelay, all things that I had really dreamed of, and suddenly it was happening, and I was the main interpreter and translator for the opera company because my French was getting pretty good then.
So you're going back and forth, is that what I hear?
Yes. Oh. At that point, I decided to apply to the Beaux-Arts in Paris, and I got in, and I lived. I finished up at Sonoma State, and then I moved to France and lived there for 6 years.
And what's the Beaux-Arts?
The École des Beaux-Arts is a kind of historic public art university in Paris where Degas and Delacroix and Matisse went and taught, and it sits on the Seine across from the Louvre, and it's a it's a very old school kind of academy, and it was very interesting to be in a socialist country where my education, which was happening at a very top level, cost me $70 a year. In those days, Americans paid. There were very few Americans because everything was conducted in French, but a really world-class education was almost free.
Let me just back you up a minute, as long as we're on this subject. You also told me, Amy, that we haven't mentioned it. You actually were raised, first of all, in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, I think.
Right.
And I think you told me that had an impact on you in your youth. That youth, I guess, is still with you. Could you just touch on that before we come back to France?
So, Pittsburgh was a very industrial city, and that goes back to the fact that it sits on three rivers. So, industrial production was an ideal setting for that, and so. Steel mills were still very active in my youth, and the really, truly awesome edifices that were the steel mills and the pollution that they created in those days, we didn't really think of the term pollution. It was just this kind of psychedelic stacks of smoke that were pink and orange and yellow, and they kind of infected the rivers with these bright colors. I grew up after the days when Pittsburgh was just full of soot. People of my parents' generation had to wear masks in order to protect themselves from the toxins. But for us, it was just a little down in the heels, but a very still vibrant city culturally, but geographically it had huge impacts on me, just those rivers and those factories and those mills. And then the very kind of socioeconomic racial mix that was pretty much on fire in the late 60s when I was in high school. That also had a big impact, and I come from a family of activists, and as a family and as a community, there was a lot of engagement with just social justice issues. So that kind of had very big imprint on me.
And you came out to California on your own then, to school?
No, we moved as a family to California in my teens. And we moved to Southern California where to a surf town, which was very exciting to get out of Pittsburgh, but really felt literally like a fish out of water. And at that point, I was doing everything I could to go to France. And that's how I got out of high school, graduated early, and went to visit a few people I knew in France who were a little older and in art school. But California, similarly, Southern California, we lived at the beach. We faced oil derricks that were out on these artificial islands. So when the sun would set, the L.A. pollution would make the skies really orange. And a bit like Pittsburgh, there was this sort of denatured, artificial sensibility to the landscape, which really came across in my paintings for many, many years. The paintings were sort of abstracted landscapes where the sky could be orange or yellow or pink, and there was something ominous while maybe also being kind of magnetic and attracting.
Okay, so let's go back to Paris then for a minute. You described the school as old school. For a start, I wondered if you could tell us what you mean by that, and then you used the word public art. So could we go through those two concepts?
Sure. The Beaux-Arts school, when I say it was old school, I mean it was in a really ancient, beautiful edifice, which was crumbling and in very poor condition, but basically I was interested in having a very traditional training, kind of an underpinning, though I knew I would become much more experimental. And so I worked for the first years drawing and painting from the model. I took extensive anatomy, morphology classes, technique classes where we copied old master's paintings, did fresco, things like that. So that's what I mean by old school. At the time, the Beaux-Arts didn't even offer photography classes, let alone video, or notions of conceptual art were not embedded in that school. But I was living in Paris, so I was out seeing very experimental pieces, even working with certain experimental artists like the Korean videographer Nam June Paik. So I had a very dualistic time there. I think it opened my eyes to what good, great public art could be, though I probably didn't have the term public art in mind, just because, you know, starting with the Eiffel Tower, there's enormous manifestations of visual art, visual components in Europe that pretty much beat lots of what we had done here that I was aware of.
Well, tell us a bit more about that public art. Why, what do you mean by that?
You mean what I mean by public art generally?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
in
and a little bit more about what it was, the Eiffel Tower. What else is an example of what interested you?
Well, the Eiffel Tower really interested me because I learned that it was such an immense, I mean, today it's this gigantic tourist attraction, and people just think of it as something that's always been there. But in its you know, early conceptual years, it was fought against by even very progressive artists. You know, it was truly revolutionary, and it was a way to somewhat herald this new age of modernity and industrialization. And it's still an outrageous object set in that landscape. It just towers over everything in Paris. And coincidentally, the place that I lived for the last few years in Paris was an artist. It was a squat, and it was built with the remainders of the 1889 World's Fair when they built the Eiffel Tower. They dismantled the World's Fair around it and built these little alleys for tradespeople to live in and to work, and I ended up being part of a group that squatted one of these to prevent it from being torn down by a developer, and we were successful. But public art could involve, like what we now have in the Bay Area, the Bay Lights that go across the Bay Bridge. It has a quality of permanence, though in the case of the Bay Lights it may not be. But it's something that impacts people beyond just what a discrete sculpture or a mural might do. I think that public art can create community and create conversation around itself beyond just sort of razzle-dazzle firework that just is kind of a one-liner. I think really good public art does elevate questions of visual literacy and questions of the day about the materials that are perhaps on the cutting edge. And it can create a sense of community by having these conversations, often conversations that are very difficult and can tear at a community, but ultimately are hopefully building a community.
So you came back to the States then after some time? And
yes.
And you began working as in the abstract, is that what you've said?
Yes, I moved back to San Francisco in 83, and I really moved back because I was involved with and married a landscape architect, who I'm still married to, and with whom, Jeffrey Miller, whom I have often collaborated. He's a builder and a designer, and I maintained a studio where my practice was one of creating abstract paintings and collages for the most part, but eventually I got engaged in public-built projects, some of that through my relationship to Jeff and also perhaps through my past history of working in theater and understanding three-dimensional space. But in terms of the abstract paintings, that's a very private space to be in making studio work. It's kind of a primal space, and I think of it as somewhat of a dance. Most of my work... Would you like me to talk
yeah.
about a little bit about the studio work?
Yeah, I well, sure I would, but just a second. I need to pause here. This is... KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our program today is an antinomian hour. Our guest is the San Francisco artist Amy Trachtenberg. We've been talking to her about her working to become an artist in school and in France and now back here in San Francisco. So sure, Amy, let's hear what you can tell us about how you see your work.
Okay. As I mentioned to Cal earlier, it's very difficult to describe abstract paintings on the radio, but I could talk a little bit about the process of how I work. And that, for the most part, I'd say that my paintings are process-oriented. They're very much grounded in the natural world, and in some ways, I might say, the unnatural world. I don't work strictly in oil or acrylic. I mix those mediums. I'm very interested in the interaction between those chemicals that are often... There's a way in which artists usually lay down paint, and I like to kind of mix that up against the grain. I'm very interested in shadows and a sense of motion in my work. There's allusions to photography. There's allusions to maps. There's mainly a kind of editing of information that's very real. That could come from directly from my life, from the newspaper, from things going on in the world, or from nature, and that is what gets translated in the process of making the paintings. I work in the studio in a very wide-ranging way. That's somewhat like a dance studio because I put my paintings flat on the floor, and they're often quite large. They can be 8 feet long. 8 feet high, so they're, you know, bigger than body size. I also work very tiny. So that's probably enough about the painting process. People, if they're interested, could look at my website or come to the gallery and see the work. But it's a process that might involve the use of materials that I find, roofing tar, sand, cinders, could get mixed into the paint. So it's kind of a scooping up of the world, I'd say.
Okay. And how do we move from that then to what might be a little bit easier to discuss on the radio, to your public art and work like that that you've done at the San Jose Library and a few other places I'll ask you about. But maybe tell us about your work at the San Jose Library.
Okay. There was a bond measure passed in the early 2000s that San Jose would either renovate or create 24 new libraries. And I was chosen for commission for a library in southeast San Jose, an area that was known to have a lot of gang warfare. It was a poor community, and it was formerly farm workers. And I felt very fortunate to be chosen to work on a project in that community because I have quite a bit of experience with the farm worker movement starting in Pittsburgh. But that didn't come forward right away that history was there. I was really brought together with the architects. The building was just barely designed. It hadn't been finished. The plans were not yet finished, and it hadn't begun to be built. So I had a very early start, which was very fortuitous. I was able to meet the community and start to hear their stories and meet with the architects and actually influence the shape of the building so that we were able to conceive and integrate a sense of a rotunda in the entry of the building, and that rotunda would become like my canvas. And on that canvas, I took the stories of the community that most resonated, which was that of the farm workers, who now are no longer doing that because that whole area has been paved. And in this rotunda, I claimed the 8 structural columns, and they became sculptural forms to which I clad them with 40 tractor tires, and I used tractor tires from the mid-century, reproductions of tractor tires from the mid-century, and very finely milled old-growth redwood. There's 4 elements in each of these columns, and they each are evocative of different aspects of the labor history of that particular area. So packing crates, fruit canning, the tractor tires, and the uppermost area of the columns are clad in madrone branches. And the madrone branches really symbolize what was there in the pre-agricultural area when native people used circles of madrone trees as meeting places or council areas. So I was able to evoke, you know, quite a long history through abstraction in the structural columns. And above that, in a frieze that encircles the rotunda, there's 26 paintings on wood, on thin wood that take the curve of the building. And those are all abstract, and they are also evoking the working of the land from the point of view, from the stories of those former farm workers, what it felt like to be up in the trees, what it felt like to plant the rows, and so on. So though I was told that such a community would not understand abstract art, that I really needed to do something literal and narrative, I really refuted that and felt that there is a universal language in abstraction. It occurs across all cultures, the same motifs occur across cultures. And I just persevered with that. And I think that, you know, we all felt the rewards in the opening days when people had their own stories to tell about identifying immediately with what these objects were in the columns and kind of looking into the paintings and saying, yeah, that really feels like what it felt like to have the tree shadows casting down on our arms and in our faces, and what this area looked like, all striped with agriculture. So that project involved a lot of manual labor and a lot of collaboration. I certainly didn't do it all myself. I had amazing collaborators in terms of crafts people, engineers. My husband was a very dynamic part of that in terms of, you know, I had this idea of how I wanted things to feel and to look and what the materiality would be. The community really wanted real materials. They felt they lived in a surround of strip malls and things that were built in a sort of subpar manner. So one of their wishes was for real materials. And Jeff, as a builder and a landscape architect, surrounds us in those materials, and we've built our house together. And so it just became natural that we would give back to the community something that would be very tactile and very durable.
Well, what was the process by which you came to understand that people wanted, as you say, real materials and were concerned about the unreality of their communities and neighborhoods?
Well, there's a very good format in the public art program in San Jose where they bring, a new project is not advertised, but the word is put out to the community that there's going to be a series of community meetings where we want their input. Not as designers, not as artists, but as people that care about what's going to happen in their community, that they're going to have this new building, that there's going to be a percent for art, and the artwork can, you know, just reflect aspects of their histories or whatever. What are their desires for their new building? This was like one of the only civic buildings in the area, and we had a lot of non-English language speakers come, Asian, Filipino, and Latino. And we had translators, interpreters in the meetings. And two generations of a lot of the people that came had been farm workers. And, you know, there could have been other stories, but you can't, I'm not interested in kind of creating a cultural schism. And that's always a very big risk where you kind of enter the cultural arms race and try to reflect something from every culture, and inevitably something's left out. But this area was known as the Valley of the Heart's Delight. And it's been rendered in a very nostalgic way, without the labor, just the kind of pretty photos, pretty drawings and renderings of cute women holding baskets of apricots. And so I really wanted to go against that grain and show what the work felt like, making, you know, building the packing lugs, the crates, the canneries. So the print, I had school children that I met with. We worked on art projects together. The principal of the school, some of the community leaders brought other people in. And so there's just kind of a diverse, dynamic group of people who were weighing in on what they thought was important. And that can be a edgy, risky situation because there can be a lot of competing stories, and ways in which they are told can be more divisive than inclusive, and inclusivity is what we aim for. But inclusivity can be very diluting in an art process.
And public libraries, public buildings, let alone public buildings with art, sounds kind of archaic to me. What happened in San Jose that a project like this could get off the ground and be completed?
Well, it is an interesting question, Cal, because they passed this bond measure at, I guess, before the first decline in the economy, in the dot-com economy. They were having a real boom, and they thought they really needed to invest in their social commons. And it was a very brilliant, forward-thinking investment for a city to make. But in the end, the bottom fell out of their economy, and they built several new libraries that they never had the funding to open them. The structures are sitting there, and they haven't moved out of their old library into their new library. So there's this boom and bust cycle happening there right now. But it was a forward-thinking administration and population that said we need to invest in the public space of the commons, and libraries are what we want to do.
And can listeners, if they're in the area, visit the library?
Oh, everybody can visit the library.
And where is it?
It's called the Hillview Library. And it's in the, so if you just look up Hillview Branch Library in San Jose, it's in the King and Story neighborhood, also known as Tropicana. And not coincidentally, it's the same part of San Jose where Cesar Chavez sort of launched the farm workers movement, the United Farm Workers. Hmm. So it's very visitable. It's very intact, despite all kinds of warnings that, you know, youth would vandalize whatever I did if it was at, you know, touching level. At first they tried to direct me to put everything above 8 feet high, and I really refused to do that. And I would encourage all artists to refuse a lot of the parameters that committees set for them. You really can refuse it, and you really can find a lot of precedents where giving beautiful, well-made, thoughtful projects back to a community in almost every case end up remaining very protected.
Hmm. And you've continued work in that area, among others, I guess. Could you tell us a bit about, are you working now, or have you finished work at the, is it the Milpitas BART station?
I'm working on the Milpitas BART station, which is just north of San Jose. It'll be the extension of BART from Oakland down to San Jose. It's going to start to connect the bay through BART. And that commission for me involves the entire passenger platform. It's huge. It's like the size of a football field and a half. It'll be the station where people will get off to go to the new 49ers stadium. And it's also in the heart of Silicon Valley. So there, for that station, I've been engaged in, for many, many years, working with the architects and the community. And that station is going to be clad in artist-made ceramic tiles. The tiles, the project's called Ecstatic Voyaging, and I'm using the community's request that the station have a jewel-like quality. And so I've created ceramic tile motifs that borrow from a pattern that exists in Islamic and Indian and Asian and even English ceramics and textiles. And it's a pattern that translates as, in Buddhism, wish-fulfilling jewel. It's called Chintamani. And it's a series of spheres, and I think it will be actually quite a meditative place, and it will be kind of both active and restorative for people that are commuting daily and will have something to focus on and be soothed by. So that's the degree of storytelling in that station. It's really going to be kind of some brilliant blues and turquoise and golden yellows.
And is this just on the platforms in the center? What?
So it will span the entire station of the entire platform, the length of the platform. It's 20 structural columns, and they're very big, wide, broad, 4 foot across columns that are in the shape of ziggurats. And the rest of the station will have some of the color and hues from the columns. And then otherwise there'll be, you know, the maps and the advertising. I'm controlling what's possible for me to control. It's not, you know, there's often compromises in these settings because, you know, as artists we often go into a clean gallery or a museum, and it's a pretty controlled environment. But in the public realm, there's all kinds of interferences, many which are pretty unfortunate. Like, oh, we have to put the fire alarms there and the signage and the advertising. So they promised me the columns would be safe from all of that. And columns are something that I've been pretty obsessed with from my travels, and I've just seemed to be using them as a vehicle for a place for art.
Okay, and one more project, if you don't mind, please. Okay. It's the Youth Center in Hayward that you're working with.
Okay, well, that is at the Ashland Youth Center. It's also called REACH, R-E-A-C-H is the acronym. And that project is up. It's finished. That was a collaboration with the architect Mallory Kusenberry, and it was one of the redevelopment agency's last funded projects. It's a, like $30 million new youth center, which is incredible. It's in a very, very underserved area near Hayward, San Leandro, an unincorporated town called Ashland that has a very, very high degree of youth trafficking, teen prostitution, teen incarceration, and so it became evident that something was missing there. And over a dozen years ago, a youth group was started, and they began to advocate for a youth center. They wanted somewhere legal and nice that they could hang out. And so those same youth who were very, very young teenagers have seen this project through. They've become advocates, and a lot of them are now employed at the youth center. And what my part, I mean, very proud of this project, have been associated with it all. What I did is I designed, in collaboration with the architect, the exterior skin of the building, which is made of porcelain and ceramic tile, and it's off-the-shelf tile. It's tile that was low-end, available, ready-made tile, but we created patterns with it, and the patterns are derived, again, from conversations with the youth, with the police, with the fire workers, with youth counselors. What did they want their building to evoke? What was the attitude that they wanted the building to give back to the community? So while we don't designate them as co-artists, they're kind of the soul and voice of what gives shape to where the artwork would go. And it's a pretty unprecedented project in terms of its commitment to the youth and them being able to help in creating their physical environment. So we led classes with them where they were introduced to practices of collage and assemblage and how abstraction and colors have their own voices. Like, if you make something that's red, what does that signal? We did have constraints of what colors we could use in this building because of gang issues, so everything that was in any way connected to red or blue was ruled out. And that's something that continually comes up in my projects, are the kind of color war issues. And it's very sad, and it's very real.
So explain. That's I hadn't thought of that. Explain color wars.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, in Mendocino, this doesn't come up very much, but in the urban realm, not just kids, people have to really be aware of what they're wearing and what they're putting on their buildings. I mean, I was pretty shocked that I had wanted to use terracotta, like brick color, different types of tile and terracotta, because it seemed like such a universal material. And they said, no, that's going to be too red, because the gangs are kind of divided into reds and blues. Norteños, Sureños is in the Mission in San Francisco. And in other areas, the gang colors still come back to red and blue. And it's enough to just be wearing a red bandana, and you can be the target of someone that's in a gang that is symbolized by a different color. It's very real, and it's been going on for decades. And, you know, a youth center like this is a place of conversation and reconciliation and education and opportunity. There's just beautiful opportunities in terms of music and filmmaking and dance and art classes and job training skills. And they really want to get beyond this because it's such a trap, but it's very real. And even the BART station, I'm using a lot of blue, and they had to take my design to the police to ask them if they thought there was too much blue in the BART station.
Okay.
So, you know, if you come to the mission, it's after being here a while, you're told that you learn that these color wars are still very real. I mean, it's just like a clannish thing that is spiraling, and I think we're all trying to figure out how to put an end to it.
This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. The program today is an Antinomian Hour, and our guest is the San Francisco artist and public artist, Amy Trachtenberg, and we've been talking about her work. Amy, switching subjects a bit, I thought I'd ask you about, I know you spent a lot of time in France, but you've traveled widely elsewhere as well, and it seems to show up in the titles of what you do and in your shows and so forth. Maybe you could tell us just a bit about that and how it connects to what you do as a working artist. You've traveled, I think you said at the beginning, to India and the Middle East. And why do you do that? Is it just for fun? Is it part of your outlook?
I think it's just, I don't know. It's in my, it's just something I've always, you know, as a child, I traveled via National Geographic, I think. I always thought I would live in another country and work with other people that were very different than me, and I have a good ear for languages, and I speak a few languages and understand a few languages, and you know, I'm not an acquisitive person, so any funds I have, I want to use for traveling, and I think it just feeds me and endlessly. You know, there's nothing else that opens the eyes, I think, quite as much as being away from the comfort zone.
And India more so than elsewhere, or?
Pardon me?
India? Did you go
well,
to?
Well, India's the most different place that I've been in terms of facing the unexpected. And it's the first time I went, I was invited by friends, and I had 4 days to prepare. They had an extra ticket, and they just invited me, and I jumped on their trip. And it was a trip to hear music and see dance in South Indian temples. And I felt so undeserving of this trip because, to me, India was the ultimate place to research before going, and I thought I would need, you know, years and years of research before going. But my friend, who's a noted musician and has been to India many, many times, said, you only just beginning, you'll have the rest of your life to try to figure it out, and you won't figure it out. So you just, that's why we keep going back. India is just this place where you know, it's not like yes and no are facts. There's these huge gray areas of maybe or possibly or we'll see. And it's just so ingrained in that culture, and it's so different than the way we live. And it's just this shock of, you know, it's relentless. It's relentless in its energy, and its visual impact is just so charged. And at the same time, there's just these places of deep devotion that do not feel exclusive. It's not the type of orthodoxy that I've experienced in the West. It's not the, though I think we could call these places that I sort of idealize, we could call them fundamentalist, yet there's this openness and just drenched with beauty and sound and, you know, animal life and fire and water and stone and textiles and color and patterns and very curious people, very open people. So, yeah, it's a place that I really haven't gotten enough of as a much younger person, going to Mexico was perhaps the first place where I felt that way, felt very opened up and very invited into it.
And
it's later Morocco.
It's impacted your work, you think?
Yeah, I think that the saturation of sound and taste and smell and certainly color and the activity of marketplaces and street culture, you know, I want to take all that in, and then I want to put it back in this way that, like, I have a very recent painting that's called Total Noise, and it's going to be in a show this summer at Brian Gross Gallery. It's being a part of a group show at his gallery, and Total Noise is I'm forgetting the name of this writer that David Foster Wallace, coined that phrase, total noise. It's the information glut that we subject ourselves to through, you know, through the internet and just all too much media and input. And so this painting that I'm actually looking at right now is kind of my stab at translating total noise. It just feels like a lot of information coming all at once, and there's metallic paints, and there's scraped away areas. It's a very, very tall, skinny painting on wood. And I think that, you know, I'm really interested in trying to capture the essence of both the material world and the immaterial world, the kind of ineffable things like shadow and sound and moving light. And I just think a place like when we get outside of home, we can feel those things because we're much more vulnerable. I mean, I've got a quote right here. I've got a stack of books in front of me, and this is from the Rabindranath Tagore, the poet, that sort of a great hero in India, who died in the early part of the century, of the 20th century. This piece of a poem he wrote, "The traveler has to knock at every alien door to come to his own, and one has to wander through all the outer worlds to reach the innermost shrine at the end." And that, I think that has a lot of the qualities of what it feels like to go from the external world in India inside of a shrine, even if the shrine is the size of a small bathroom. Like a giant palace, or it can be the size of a telephone booth. And there's this contrast of kind of inner peace against the most riotous, insane outer world. So I think, you know, I don't know if that answers the question.
Sure. And I'm sure you have more to say, but let's take up one more topic while we still have some time. And that's a work that I think is quite well known and that you've talked about a lot, but maybe people will want to hear more about it. And that's your painting. Is it called Stripes/Sutras?
Right.
What about that?
It's a collage.
Yeah.
And it's a large-scale collage that's made from a single photograph that was a New York Times war story photograph from a few years ago when, it was a Iraqi cleric's funeral. And it was a very, I've been cutting photos out of newspapers for a long time, related mostly, well, in recent years to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with these views into people's lives. And this was particularly compelling to me for several reasons. One, just there's this host of men holding up this coffin in which this political religious hero was, his body was covered in a pink cloth, and he was dead, and just the idea of that any of our war heroes would be covered in a pink cloth is very much never going to be the case here, just because pink has such a different association. So that was one thing that struck me, but all of these hands and arms reaching up felt like something like in a Renaissance or a painting from the Middle Ages. So I manipulated that one photograph in a Xerox machine, turning it while it's copying, so I kind of stretch the images, and then I also used the masthead of the New York Times to shape it so it actually, when composed vertically, it looks like Arabic writing. And, you know, I really didn't know what I was doing when I started to work with this image. It was, you know, it took at least a year to try things out and finally land on this one particular collage. I've made others since then, but it's interesting because it takes something that's so ubiquitous in our culture, which is the front page of the paper, if you still get a paper, and it looks a bit like a prayer rug, or it looks like what it's not. The colors are amped up, and the very familiar New York Times masthead just is transformed into something of another culture. And many savvy people I know have actually thought that the imagery, though it's right out of the newspaper, was kind of like from Goya or Velázquez or El Greco. And so by going deeply inside of one image, I kind of uncovered a lot of different worlds. I'm going to have a residency at Kala Art Institute to pursue more of these war photo collages. And that's coming up in the fall.
And where is that?
That's in Berkeley. Kala Art Institute mm-hmm. is a really wonderful printmaking facility and gallery that's, you know, kind of on the cutting edge of new ways of dealing with printmaking as well as the really great old ways.
I wonder if I can ask you this question. I think it's going to sound like a dumb question, but maybe it's not.
There's no dumb question.
Are you trying to say things to us? Are there, when you paint to viewers? Are you trying to? Do you have ideas that you're trying to get out?
It's really a good question to ask an abstract artist, particularly because so many people in the face of an abstract painting, in advance of really looking at it, think, I'm not going to understand this. I don't have any bottom line with which I want people to understand what my source material is. I always have this plethora of sources that I can't expect anybody to grasp all of them, and I'm always so amazed when someone says, oh, you must have been looking at XYZ, and maybe I was, but I don't think that much at who I'm addressing or what I hope they get. I'm just trying to find my way into that material myself, but I love that if it raises questions for people and when it raises associations, like this reminds me of whether it's an aerial view of a bombed-out landscape, or a microscopic view of some cellular material, or just the effect of the color and the pattern makes them feel good or uncomfortable. I mean, that's all I can ask for.
And I haven't asked you, do you teach at all? Do you have students?
I teach occasionally, and I love to teach. I taught a few years ago at an art school in Greece, and had an international body of students. That was really wonderful. But I don't have a regular teaching gig here. I often develop curriculum in relation to my public projects that might last a month or two so that I can get a little more focus and depth from the community.
And whenever I see, descriptions of what you do, they often include others. It seems like your work is often kind of cooperative in nature. Is that correct? Or?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Well, I'm just wondering.
If it's collaborative.
Yeah, and cooperative. Do you like to work in common with other people? It seems
I really right now feel very fortunate to have a life where I have this solo studio time, but at least half of my work is collaborative and working with both communities and a really great range of communities, from children to elders to healthcare workers to youth to BART engineers, but also to work with other artists and architects and parks people or and even the administrators. I'm interested in policy. I'm interested in the way that we create our common spaces, and I think that artists can play a role. I've sat on the San Jose Arts Commission, Public Art Committee. I've spoken to the Golden Gate Bridge authorities on questions of the suicide barrier. I am very interested in the cooperative, collaborative experience because art making is otherwise very solo, and the other part of that is that what I make in my studio ultimately is for a very tiny population of, you know, art buying, 1%ers perhaps, and so I really need to be involved with a larger group of people. So, you know, I feel very lucky that I have this balance of public social projects sort of this sanctuary of the studio and making work.
We're just about out of time, Amy. Let's remind the listeners of a few things. You mentioned, and I wanted you to ask you to repeat it, that your new work, Total Noise, is going to be exhibited this year. Where was that?
It's going to be part of a group show in the gallery that represents me, and that gallery is in San Francisco on Utah Street, and it's called Brian Gross Fine Art.
Okay.
And that's his website, is Brian Gross Fine Art. And that show will probably be up through the summer. I just have one piece in it. But they have many of my pieces in the back, and you can ask them to pull them out, including Stripes Sutras, this collage that I spoke about with the war photos. And that show is going to open July 12th.
Okay, and the library that we talked about, that's in San Jose. Where was it again?
And that's called the Hillview Library. And it's embedded in the neighborhood, so it'd be best to just look up Hillview Branch Library, San Jose, and you'll get all the details of the address and the hours that they're open.
Okay. Well, thank you very much,
Amy. Both are free and open to the public. Gallery's free entry.
A rare idea, these. Anyway, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you this afternoon, and thank you again very much for coming on. And I should tell listeners one more thing, and that is that you can visit Amy Trachtenberg's website at amytrachtenberg.org.
.com.
Sorry. AmyTrachtenberg.com. So that will do it for today. Thanks again, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. This is Cal Winslow, and I'll be back here at the same time next week. So good afternoon.